This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A Milford man spent more than a decade behind bars for a robbery he still says he didn't commit. And a local organization has been working for almost as long to prove his innocence. The Ohio Innocence Project, known for being a force behind freeing wrongly convicted prisoners, says it has DNA evidence that could exonerate Kevin Thornton. Joining Cincinnati Edition to talk about the case are University of Cincinnati College of Law Assistant Professor and Ohio Innocence Project Attorney Donald Castor. Welcome, Donald.
Well, thank you.
And WCPO I-Team reporter Paula Christian. Welcome, Paula.
Thanks for having me.
You can join our conversation today at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those in the show as well. Paula, the origin of this case and how it all went down is scary and fascinating. And if, in fact, Kevin Thornton is innocent, it's a tragedy. Paula, you spoke with Kevin for a story at WCPO.
Mm-hmm.
And since we don't have him here today, can you just take us back to September 11th, 2007, and set the scene of the crime for us?
Sure. It was at a Cash Express store in Milford in kind of a shopping plaza, and a man walked in the middle of the day. Please correct me, Donald, if I've got any of the facts wrong. And he had a gun, and there was a woman working, and he wanted the money. And she said, "Are you serious?" And he cocked the gun. And so he put her down on the floor. He zip-tied her hands. She was down on the ground, and he took the money and he left. And when he left, she hit the panic button and the police came. And, she identified who she thought the robber was. Now, the robber was wearing a baseball hat and he was wearing sunglasses. So she could only identify the person from the mouth down.
And so when police were asking her for her assistance in identifying a suspect, they did one of those police lineups,
yes.
Right? But they concealed the top halves,
yes,
of the potential suspects' faces. And she identified Kevin Thornton based on,
yes,
that.
And how Kevin kind of even ended up in the mix of being in the lineup is that one or two of the police officers saw the surveillance video and thought, doesn't that look like Kevin Thornton? And which is kind of unusual because Kevin did not have a criminal record. And he said, he's like, I have no idea why they would think it was me.
Well, what kind of relationship did he have with the police for them to know his name and what he might look like?
Well, I mean, Milford's kind of a small place. He did have some traffic run-ins, some small crimes, but nothing violent, no felonies, nothing. So I don't know the answer to the question. Do you, Donald?
I really don't. I never understood why there were Milford police who really thought that they knew Kevin well enough to pick him out from this very grainy video surveillance footage.
That's a key piece of this, too. Mm-hmm. This wasn't crystal clear surveillance footage. This was 12 years ago. The technology has changed dramatically. So it was grainy and the face was almost halfway covered.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it was stop action. I mean, it was one of those videos that took a picture like every 7 seconds or so. So you couldn't even tell the way a person really moved naturally or anything like that.
When I looked at the surveillance, I didn't think it looked anything like Kevin. Kevin's very tall and thin. I mean, really thin. And the guy in the surveillance looked a little bottom heavy. He just looked heavier to me. I don't think it looked like his shape.
A little later on, we're going to talk about some new analysis of this video that the Ohio Innocence Project is using in its assistance for Kevin Thornton in his ongoing appeal. But before we get to that, Thornton is charged. Mm-hmm. With this robbery of the check cashing store, and the case goes to trial not once but twice.
Yes. Yeah,
so tell us what happened at the first trial.
The first trial was a hung jury. Kevin said there were 8 jurors who believed he was innocent and 4 who were undecided. So he was surprised when the prosecutors in Milford decided to try the case again. He thought they would drop it.
Well, what kind of evidence, if either of you can answer this question, what kind of evidence was presented at that first trial to have 2/3 of the jury come back with an acquittal before they agreed they couldn't move any further because they were hung? What were they looking at?
Well, we had the store clerk testifying that this was Kevin based on, from the nose down. Did the police officers testify at the first trial? Do you know, or what other evidence?
There was a little bit of testimony. The robbery was something that was known to the community. And when the police came to search Kevin's house, I think that based on what they said they were looking for, Kevin guessed that for some reason they thought that he was the guy who committed this robbery. And he made that comment as the police were searching. So it was basically Kevin's comment, oh, are you looking for the Milford Cash Express robber, and the store clerk's testimony.
And so the prosecution at this point has to decide whether they're going to proceed with a second attempt to convict Kevin Thornton. And they do decide that. They go forward with a second trial. But this time, they've got a new piece of evidence.
This time, they have a snitch who says, Kevin confessed to me that he committed this robbery. And I asked Kevin about this. This is a kid that he knew from high school. They weren't friends, but they knew each other. And they met in the waiting room of the probation office when Kevin was waiting to meet his probation officer. And his mother was discussing the case, and he believes this gentleman overheard the case and then kind of twisted things around so that he had some outstanding warrants, and he was trying to cooperate with prosecutors to gain an advantage on his case. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Did Kevin Thornton's mother testify at the second trial? Did she have any input on the circumstances surrounding that conversation that was allegedly overheard?
No, she didn't.
So I'm wondering, you're a lawyer, Donald. I hear things on court shows, you know, if that's hearsay, that's inadmissible. Why was this taken so seriously?
Well, it was taken seriously because the police took it seriously and because juries like to hear about confessions. Mm-hmm. One of the leading causes of wrongful convictions can be a confession, whether it's made and it's false or whether it's just made up by whoever's making it up.
But this one sounds like it was an indirect confession.
Well, not only that, it sounds very implausible. Kevin was at the it's important to remember that Kevin was at the probation department, not because he was on probation himself, but because it was a condition of his bond prior to trial that he check in with a probation officer.
This is between the first and second trial.
This is between the first and the second trial. The gentleman who ends up, claiming that Kevin told him that he committed this crime was on probation and had his own set of new charges while he was on probation, which is a really bad combination in the criminal justice system. The notion that Kevin would sit in the middle of a probation department and confess to some guy that he hadn't seen from high school that he committed this armed robbery just seems laughable to me. But we know that the juries take these things seriously all the time, and it's unfortunate.
And that seems evident because armed with this confession, the prosecution takes this back to trial for a second time. Paula, tell us what happens.
Well, Kevin really felt like this jury was against him from the beginning. It was an older jury. He did not feel like they were taking his case. He felt like they just wanted a conviction. And his attorney tried to say, look at the height difference. Look how tall. So Kevin is 6'4", right? He's 6'4". He's a really tall guy. And in this surveillance video, the man who's committing the robbery doesn't look that much taller than the female, the female clerk. He does not look tall. And Kevin's attorney told the jury, there's no way this could be Kevin. Kevin's so much taller than this. And he tried to use a little sort of courtroom science and say, trying to measure it out without calling an expert to say this couldn't be Kevin. We analyzed it. We measured it. So there was no expert testimony that Kevin had in his defense. So he was convicted.
What was his alibi in this? Where did he say he was at the time of this robbery?
He was in his apartment. He lived with his mom. And didn't he say he was sleeping?
Yes.
And his mom was there. So that was his alibi.
Okay, so what did Thornton tell you about his feelings at that moment when the jury came back?
Oh, he was just crushed. I mean, he just couldn't believe this was happening. And he kept thinking, they've got to believe me. I've got to find some way to convince them this isn't me. He just couldn't believe what was happening to him.
You mentioned that he had no criminal record and that there really was no reason for the Milford police to have any sense of familiarity with him. But what was his life like prior to this? Where did he work? What was his day-to-day existence like?
You would know better than I would, Donald. His mother was his best friend. So there were a couple unusual things that I'll weigh in and let Donald weigh in. His mother was his best friend. He lived with his mother, and you know, he literally talked to his mother every day, which is very unusual for, you know, somebody who's committing armed crimes. He was not a drug addict. He was not an alcohol addict, which is, again, unusual. And he didn't have much of a criminal record, just some traffic violations, which, again, very unusual for somebody who's going to decide to pick up a gun and go rob a cash express.
So he's sentenced to 12 years and he's shipped off to the Lebanon Correctional Institute in Warren County. What was his life like there?
Well, it was terrible for 5 years because that's where they house very violent offenders. And he didn't have much time out of his cell. He spent 20 hours a day in a cell where he couldn't extend his hands all the way without touching the walls. And he shared it with, sometimes he had good roommates, sometimes he had bad ones. And, you know, they would tell him when to sleep, when to watch TV, it was very intimidating for Kevin. Kevin went into prison with no tattoos and he started getting tattoos so that he would appear tougher, that he would blend in so he wouldn't get picked on. He had to learn very quickly how to survive with some very violent people.
So he comes to the Ohio Innocence Project. He writes to the organization. His case is selected as his appeals process goes on. Kevin Thornton has always maintained his innocence here. And we're going to talk about why the Ohio Innocence Project took this case on. And we're also going to talk a little bit about that analysis of the surveillance video that was used against him and how it may help his case this time. We're going to take a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Kevin Thornton was sentenced to prison for robbing a local check cashing store, and he spent more than a decade behind bars. He's in a halfway house now, but he's always maintained his innocence. The Ohio Innocence Project says it can help him prove it. Let's continue our conversation now with University of Cincinnati College of Law Assistant Professor and Ohio Innocence Project Attorney Donald Castor and WCPO I-Team reporter Paula Christian. Kevin Thornton told WCPO Paula that when the Ohio Innocence Project decided to take his case, it felt like hitting the lottery.
Yeah, he did, because he said in prison, you know, inmates said you have to try to reach the Ohio Innocence Project. But so many inmates reach out to them for help. They take such a small percentage. The fact that they took Kevin's case was just huge to him for somebody who's been trying to prove his innocence. So it was a big deal.
Donald, talk about what this case looked like when it showed up at your door and why you decided to take it on.
Sure. And we've been working on the case for so long that the case actually started with my predecessor at the Ohio Innocence Project. But we look for cases where there's the possibility of finding new evidence that could point to someone's innocence. And in this case, we thought that there were two different things that could be done. One is we thought that there was the possibility of finding DNA on the zip ties that were used to bind the hands and feet of the cash checking store clerk. The other was we thought we could do an analysis of the video to figure out how tall the actual perpetrator of the crime was.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because DNA is a huge component of the work that you do. So what did you find?
So the zip ties were subjected to DNA testing, and there was a method used on the DNA testing that only looks for a male's DNA. It only looks for DNA from the Y chromosome, which only men have, of course. And that was to rule out the possibility that we would detect the store clerk, who was a woman. What we found was that both zip ties had the same male's DNA profile, and that male was not Kevin Thornton.
You've been quoted in the WCPO article about Kevin Thornton's experience here. Quote, DNA evidence for the courts is usually the gold standard. So we've been very surprised that given the strength of the evidence that we haven't been successful in setting aside Kevin's conviction. What do you think's going on here?
I think that this is a classic example of tunnel vision. of prosecutors and sometimes even judges reaching a conclusion, valuing finality in the legal process more than correctness of the legal process. And of people with a vested interest in the outcome of the case rejecting facts that contradict their preformed conclusion about a case.
You also have this new analysis of the surveillance footage that was taken during the robbery. Tell us about that and what it shows.
Sure. This is a technique called photogrammetry, and it's a technique that is almost as old as photographs themselves. Basically, if you take a photograph or even a still image from a video, and if you know the height of a particular object in that picture, then you can figure out, basically using geometry, the height of all of the other objects in that picture. So we hired an expert, a man by the name of Phil Locke, and he went out and he measured one of the objects in the cash checking place, so he'd have that known height. And then using that and using the angles of the camera, he was able to figure out that the height of the actual perpetrator was 5'11", significantly shorter than Kevin.
Yeah, you've said that Kevin is 6'4".
Kevin's 6'4", so 5 inches difference, which that's a huge difference in height.
Well, this technology you referenced, Donald, you said that it's been around as long as photographs.
Almost.
Why wasn't it used in the first trial or the second trial?
Unfortunately, Mr. Thornton's trial attorney either didn't know about it or didn't think that it was important enough to do.
So even with this information, though, the appeal has been denied by the Claremont County judge who presided over the original trial. It's also been denied by a U.S. District Court magistrate.
It has. And in fact, you know, we went first to the judge who heard the case originally. And the judge who heard the case originally actually said in his opinion denying a new trial that that photogrammetry probably would have made a difference to the jury. It probably would have been a lot better than just his defense attorney saying, look at the two of them, look at Kevin in the courtroom and see how much taller he is than what it looks like the perpetrator in the picture is. But the judge said that evidence should have been presented at the time of trial. Since it wasn't, the judge said, he was procedurally barred from considering it. So even though it was compelling evidence, he said the law didn't permit him to consider that evidence.
Do you agree with that? Is that something on the books that says, look, the game's over, you don't get to try a new play now?
Well, we do disagree with the judge's interpretation in this case, particularly because we also brought DNA evidence in the case. And in Ohio, there's a statute that deals specifically with DNA testing and what happens with DNA testing post-conviction. And it says that in determining whether a person is actually innocent, the judge is supposed to look at all of the available evidence. And we think the judge should have looked at the DNA evidence alongside of the photogrammetric analysis and come to the conclusion, as we have, that Kevin is actually innocent of this crime.
The technicality that the U.S. District Court magistrate used to deny the appeal, I don't fully understand myself, just being a journalist and not in the legal profession. So I'm going to read another journalist direct reporting, Paula Christian, our other guest. So this is word for word from your report. Because the U.S. Supreme Court has not recognized a freestanding actual innocence claim as a reason to overturn a conviction, it was ruled that exonerating prisoners like Thornton is beyond the authority of federal courts in these cases. Can you explain that to us, Donald?
Sure. And I think this surprises a lot of people. The United States Supreme Court has never held that being in prison and being actually innocent runs afoul of the United States Constitution. In other words, if you have a trial that the federal courts deem as procedurally okay, that is, there wasn't evidence that was improperly seized, there wasn't a confession that shouldn't have been taken, all of the procedural things that can go wrong at or before a trial. If you can't prove one of those things, then simply proving that you're innocent doesn't prove that your constitutional rights have been violated.
And that was the most shocking thing for me. I've been a reporter a long time. I've covered a lot of cases. And I assumed that if you could prove your innocence, then you would be released from prison. And the fact that it doesn't matter really stunned me. And a lot of the people involved in the story, in reading it, in editing it, were just as confused. I don't understand if he's innocent and they can prove he's innocent. Why is he still in prison?
And so the appeal process goes on. It's now in the hands of a U.S. District Court judge, Michael Barrett. What does that mean?
Well, the case is always, once we were in federal court, the case is assigned to Judge Barrett. But as a matter of of practice, the judges assign cases to the magistrate judges to make recommendations before they make a final ruling. So Magistrate Judge Merz recommended that our petition for relief be denied. We've objected to that, and we've pointed out the places where we think that the magistrate judge got things less than correct. And we're hopeful that Judge Barrett will take a fresh look at this case again and come to the conclusion that, Kevin is actually innocent. And we also have an additional claim, which is that Mr. Thornton's trial attorney should have done this photogrammetric analysis, probably should have done the DNA analysis prior to trial, and that as a result, Mr. Thornton didn't receive the constitutionally guaranteed right to effective assistance of counsel.
The state attorney general's office is fighting the appeal process. Why do you think?
I think it's because it's their job to fight the appeals process. Remember that the Ohio Attorney General's office only steps in once we're in federal court. Before that, it's handled by the local prosecutor's office. And they look at these cases with the presumption that everything was done correctly. So they have a client. It's the state of Ohio. They're making their case on behalf of the state of Ohio.
Kevin Thornton is no longer in prison. He's still incarcerated. Technically, he's in a halfway house now.
Yeah, he's in the Talbert House. He arrived in June to serve out the last 6 months of his sentence, and they prepare him for release in December, try and help him find a job, a place to live. But those things are going to be a problem for Kevin because he has to register as a violent offender. And, you know, not a lot of people want to hire somebody like that. So he's very worried about finding a place to live and finding a job. And he very much wants to clear his name.
Yeah, that was my very next question, was the benefit of pushing forward. Like, he's served his time that he was sentenced 12 years.
Yeah.
So the benefit is...
Well, yeah, it affects the outcome of the rest of his life. He's still a young guy. I mean, he's 38. And, you know, what's interesting is his mother, who always fought for him, who was his best friend, who he talked to every day when he was in prison, she died a couple of months ago. So he never got to see her. She died before he was released.
So yeah, I want you to talk about his feelings about that, because she's gone now before this final outcome, which could be good for him, comes to light. And how does he feel about that?
Well, he feels as if he has to keep fighting to prove his innocence to honor his mother's legacy, because she fought so hard for him that now he's doing it for her to clear his name.
Has he talked about what he wants to do with his life if all this finally goes his way?
Well, I asked him a lot about it, and he is kind of reluctant to talk about it because I don't think he really knows what he wants to do. He's been in prison so long. He was employed as a landscaper before prison, so I think he wants to do that again. And, you know, he just wants to do the things that we all do, go to Kings Island, eat La Rosa's, you know, have a steak, drink real Coke or real Pepsi, and, you know, just watch TV.
Does he have any family?
No, he has no siblings. His mother passed away, so he doesn't have any family or friends left.
What happens next? We know it's in the hands of this district judge in the federal court system, but is there a date?
No, there's no date. The state, you know, the magistrate judge made his recommendation, and we've objected to it. The state has to respond. Once the state responds, it'll be fully in Judge Barrett's court, so to speak, and he'll make a decision one way or the other.
The Innocence Project has gotten more than 10,000 requests for help from prisoners proclaiming their innocence. Talk a little bit about that process of review. You mentioned that you're looking for cases where new evidence may emerge, but gosh, how do you even technically get through those types of requests?
So inmates looking for our help, people who are incarcerated looking for our help, fill out an application. And as long as they were convicted in Ohio and they're saying that they were actually innocent, we'll start to look at their case and we'll start to investigate their case.
But so these are just Ohio inmates?
Just Ohio inmates.
Oh my gosh.
Just Ohio inmates. None of us are licensed outside of Ohio, so we just work on Ohio cases. And, you know, we'll start to reconstruct the crime investigation. We'll gather all of the public records from the police. We'll get a person's file from their trial attorney, and we'll start to try to reconstruct what happened. And we'll start to reconstruct if something went wrong, and if so, where it went wrong.
10,000 applications. How many cases have you taken on?
Well, asserting actual innocence, we've gone to court for people probably in fewer than 50 of those cases. That doesn't mean that there's only 50 cases that we've looked at where we thought the person was actually innocent. That just means that those are the only people who we thought we could meet the really high standards for going to court and proving their innocence.
Yeah, that's something I'd like to know is, do you think that there could be 10,000 innocent people behind bars in Ohio?
I don't know if it's as many as 10,000 innocent people. The number is higher than people would like to believe it is. The National Academy of Sciences did a study a few years ago, and they concluded that just on death row, the error rate in the United States is probably about 4%, which may seem low, but when you consider the number of people who are incarcerated, that's a really high number. And if you assume that Ohio is neither no better than or no worse than anyone else at administering, say, the death penalty, then that means in Ohio alone, there's probably five people on death row who don't belong there. So 4% is a pretty significant number. And that means that there's thousands of people both in Ohio and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands in the United States who are in prison who shouldn't be there.
In our last 15 seconds here, what's the biggest factor usually in someone being wrongfully convicted?
Usually it's either a bad eyewitness identification, a false confession, or some sort of junk forensic science.
Well, it looks like you got two out of the three in this Kevin Thornton case. At least that's the position that you're taking.
Yes.
Our thanks to Donald Caster from UC and the Ohio Innocence Project and WCPOI team reporter Paula Christensen for joining us to talk
Thank
about
you.
The case. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Up next, a local comedian finds the humor in aging, dating, and more. Our conversation is next. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. I'm Michael Monks. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org.